It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Student debt, car loans, credit card debt, mortgages, medical debt. It's easy to take on a lot of debt in our culture. A recent survey showed that the average American carries $38,000 in personal debt, and that's without factoring in home mortgages. This hour, we're going to talk about debt and get some advice on how to climb out of it. Joey Beach, author of A Girl's Guide to Personal Finance, will join us later in the hour. But first, Chris Arnold, NPR personal finance correspondent and one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast, is here. Okay. The Life Kit podcast has taken on personal debt, medical debt, savings, and investment. And I believe Chris is with us on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Charity. Can you guys hear me?
I can hear you. Thank you very much.
All right, good. We were having some behind-the-scenes technical problems.
Right.
But
it was exciting
out.
There for a moment.
Keep us on our toes.
Now, Chris, for people who haven't listened to your Life Kit podcasts about debt, the Life Kit podcast is designed to be very accessible. It's designed to break down big problems into small bites. You've tackled personal finance in so many different ways over the years. What did you want to do differently with the Life Kit podcast?
Well, you know, so I've been feeling for a long time, and this is changing a little bit in recent years, but for a long time, the sort of mainstream, serious, elite news organizations, you know, we would do all kinds of stories, but we wouldn't give people sometimes just like really simple, actionable advice that we really need to know, right, to make decisions. Like, okay, how do I invest my retirement account? You know, the mainstream media would like shy away from being specific enough and simple enough and actionable enough that people could actually be like, oh, okay, here's a sample portfolio that's really awesome. And if you did this, you'd be pretty much set for the next 30 or 40 years. And it's such better high level information than you're going to get probably from a lot of financial advisors who have conflicts of interest because they get paid more money if they get you to take this mutual fund that kicks them back a fee and all this other stuff. So we started thinking like, all right, let's just, the original idea was just personal finance. And then it grew to all kinds of topics, right? And so the idea is we take NPR's sort of rigorous journalism and then bring it to topics that can help people kind of live healthier, happier lives. So whether it's like, you know, finding an exercise habit you can stick with is like one of the guides we do, or you know, how to talk to your kids about difficult topics, or how to get out of debt or invest your retirement account. Like, but you get like real scientists, behavioral experts, and NPR reporters kind of giving you the real scoop on this stuff.
So let's talk a little bit about our culture of debt in this country. I know that that's the kind of thing that we do fairly well in media coverage of debt, but I do want to paint a broader picture before we dive into some of those actionable items that people can take advantage of. But it's so easy to get into debt in our culture. Can you give me your impression of sort of how we've created this culture of debt?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it goes back decades, but certainly it's gotten a lot easier for people to borrow money, and credit is extended in ways now that it didn't used to be, right? I mean, you used to go to a bank and things were very serious, and the bank, you know, just had its little bit of money that it would lend out, and so it was a very formal and controlled. You know, now there's the financial system's just gotten so complex that, you know, you've got all like credit cards and big banks and subprime lending. And, you know, I mean, we got into trouble in the housing crisis just because of how crazy it all got. And I think it used to be like, I don't know, two generations ago, if a bank would loan you money, you could probably afford it, you know. And now there's all kinds of institutions that will extend you money for all kinds of different reasons, even when you really can't afford to be putting that 20 grand on a credit card. And, you know, that's certainly a big part of it.
And so many people are in debt. Do you feel like that's part of the problem? It's normal to be in debt, so it doesn't feel like a problem that you have to solve?
I mean, maybe. I think, too, you know, our human psychology plays into this. I mean, it's the stuff that I've learned just in reporting some of the podcast episodes that we did on debt, that, you know, our brains work in funny ways. Like we're so focused on the present that we, you know, behavioral economists or psychologists say, like, we prioritize the present. So, you know, if you ask somebody, I mean, if it's like health, like, oh, what are you going to have for lunch this week? You know, they'll say, oh, I think I'm going to have salad, you know, because that's healthy. And then in the moment, though, you sit down with a friend and it's lunchtime and it's like, oh, screw it, I'm going to get the burger, you know. And that's how our brains work. And it's the same with personal finance stuff. I mean, you might think, oh yeah, I'm going to be really responsible this year with money. It's January. I mean, yeah, this is the year we're going to really. And then, you know, in the moment, it's like, well, I'm tired. Let's go out to dinner. I mean, who wants to deal with cooking? It's been a long day, you know? And in that moment, I think that that's one thing you can train yourself to get better at. It's like recognizing that, setting up rules, that there are ways to sort of, you know, battle is probably the wrong word, but, you know, work with your own human psychology that's evolved over millions of years. I mean, you know, a long time ago when we were like cave people or whatever, we had to be very focused on the present because like the tiger might be chasing us or something, right? But like now, you know, some of those same things that helped us evolve or whatever, whatever the reasons are, our brains work this way can trip us up when we have credit card offers and stuff in front
of us. Right. Well, and speaking of psychology, in one of your episodes of the Life Kit podcast, you point out that when we take on more debt, we actually fool our brains into feeling like we're more prosperous, and therefore it's easier to get further into debt.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a great example. And, you know, like, and that surprised me. It's like you would never think that that's what's going on in your head, right? But that somehow, okay, I mean, because it seems crazy, right? It's like, all right, I'm $20,000 in the hole. So I'm obviously spending more than I'm making, but my solution to this problem is I'm going to keep taking on more debt. You know, it's like that just seems completely irrational, but emotionally, you know, somehow we feel richer if we have the stuff. And it just like our, you know, like, so you have to just sort of strip it down and get out of the moment. I mean, if that's one takeaway across, you know, all, you know, finance or otherwise, if you're making decisions in the moment, you know, it could also be when the stock market's crashing and it's like, no, that's a very bad time to start figuring out what your strategy is. You know, you're panicking. Taking this stuff out of the moment and having a plan is just a much more successful way to approach all kinds of things.
And while we're still talking about psychology, so many people exit college or exit their university with so much student debt. And that's got to really be a psychological blow to start your career while carrying a whole bunch of debt for what you've just done to be able to start your career.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, I mean, this has become such a national problem. I mean, it's, you know, multiple presidential candidates, right? Are it's central in their campaigns. Like, what are we going to do? You know, an entire generation of people is, you know, it's like, hey, congratulations. You know, you've graduated. You throw your hat in the air and it's like, now you owe us $50,000, $60,000. I mean, it's just, I've seen people I know, you know, who never saved anything for retirement or anything else because they felt like, well, I got to pay off my student loans first, which, by the way, is not the right approach. But, it's hard. You know, it's like, oh, geez. And then the system is so complicated, right? And in the episode we do on this, I mean, sadly, you know, and I think a lot of people mean well in the system, but it's like, look, you call up the 800 number on your student loan statement, and you might get totally bad information from the company that's servicing your loan. They might be like, oh yeah, if you can't afford, we'll just put you in forbearance, you know, which just means the interest keeps racking up and racking up and you're not paying anything. When the right answer might be, well, okay, look, if you're having trouble paying, how much are you making and what do you do? And maybe we could get you into a income-driven repayment plan that could lower your payments to what you can afford and get you on track for some sort of loan forgiveness plan. I mean, you know, especially if you have federal loans, there are good paths and there are bad paths, but as an individual trying to sort it out on your own, it can be really hard.
Now, there's a thread that runs across all of your financial advice, different categories, and it's ask for help. There are so many things that can be done to make it easier to get out of debt or even really lower your debt load. Is that your number one piece of advice? Ask for help?
Well, I think I wouldn't start there, but honestly, I'm not just plugging our episodes, but you could do something like listen to Life Kit and listen to the episode on the topic. Like, we have Secrets of Saving and Investing if you're trying to do that, or How to Get Out of Debt, or Student Loans. We have an episode, and you could learn a lot, or read Jack Bogle's book, Common Sense on Mutual Funds, which is like the quintessential sort of, Bible of how to invest, the smart way, and getting around all of the Wall Street marketing speak that will lead you astray, or David Swensen's book on investing, Unconventional Success. I mean, the thing is, you got to find a good source to start learning stuff, right? And then once you do the best you can to educate yourself, understand what's going on, because the other thing that will do is it will help you understand how to find that person to go talk to who you can trust. Because if you just walk in the front door of some random company and say, "Hey, I got money problems," it's like that's not the right approach. So, this you'll learn, okay, who should I even be going to for advice? Because that's a tough question too sometimes.
Absolutely. And I want to drill down on that. And it also depends on the kind of debt that you're carrying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff you can learn that you don't need. I mean, it's hard to find a nonprofit organization that could really help you with this. It's like, look, you might get hit. We did a whole episode on medical debt that you're probably planning on talking about. But where we have this crazy system in our country where people who have insurance or are on Medicare get charged, X for the procedure. And then if you don't have health insurance, or you thought you were covered, but your kind of catastrophic health insurance didn't pay, you get a bill that can be like five times bigger. I mean, we talked with this one guy who got like $100,000 bill for a heart operation, and he thought he was covered and he wasn't. And meanwhile, an insurance company was only pay like $22,000, or Medicare would pay $22,000 for that same procedure. And if you know what to say to the hospital, you get hit with some big bill. That's a big example, but it could be a $2,000 ambulance ride because you got in a bike accident or something. We just got a message from someone the other day that they got a hospital bill.
I'm going to wait and hear this story after a break. We're going to take
a
short break.
Sounds good.
We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Chris Arnold, NPR personal finance correspondent and one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast. We're talking about personal finance this hour. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about personal finance. We're talking about carrying a debt load and how to dig yourself out of debt. It's a situation that a lot of us are very familiar with, and we'd love to hear from you this hour. If you have questions, or maybe you have a story about how you got yourself out of debt or a plan that didn't work, we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me right now is Chris Arnold, NPR personal finance correspondent and one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast, which has taken on a lot of these topics on the podcast. And Chris, we were just touching on medical debt there before the break, and you were just about to tell me a story about someone who got a big bill.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing about medical debt is there's a few things you just have a lot of this stuff. If you just know a couple of things to say, this is an example about just having a little bit of knowledge can help you so much. So if you all nonprofit hospitals under the Affordable Care Act have to have a financial aid policy where, if you go in and you don't make much money and you get this huge bill. And like we were saying before, I mean, it's a little bit nuts, right? But people without insurance will get a bill. Sometimes it's five times bigger than what an insurance company would pay. And is it fair? No, I mean, it's not fair, but that's how the system works. So there are things you could do. So if it's a nonprofit hospital, you go and you say, well, wait, I want to know, but you'll still get hit with the bill. They don't often ask you how much you make. So then you can go in and say, well, okay, I don't make much money. I want to know what your financial aid policy is, or sometimes it's called a charity care policy. And you might get absolutely free care based on your income, even though nobody told you that, and the bill disappears. Or you could get dramatically reduced care. And somebody who listened to our podcast, I swear this is true. Yesterday, I'm looking at our Slack channel here, a way we message each other, and a friend of one of the producers sent a photo in of his ER bill. And the first, the bill was like $2,361. I don't know why he ended up in the ER. And he wrote, "Hey, do you see this stuff? This is because of your podcast." And the bill got reduced to $193.
Wow.
Just because he knew to say, hey, you know, he'd heard that, you know, he'd listened to the podcast and he was like, well, I don't make much money. What's my income? What's the financial aid policy? Wham. He just saved $2,000. And you don't need to go find a nonprofit expert because, you know, would you, for a bill like that, you're going to go to all that trouble? Sometimes just some information can really help.
Well, and I thought it was particularly poignant on your podcast when you were talking about that. And you already mentioned the man who got a $100,000 bill and he managed to get it reduced down to like $22,000, which is still a really big bill. But yeah. The hospital took him to court and he went to court and he had done all of this research and prepared to, you know, make his case, and he got his bill reduced significantly. And he talked about the other people he saw in court who were there representing themselves. And he felt like they, you know, they just absolutely did not have the knowledge and the resources to deal with this, and they didn't get any help.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, this is a sad thing. And, you know, and different hospitals are so different in this regard, right? Like some are very proactive about like trying to help you if you don't have much money or trying to, and other hospitals or nonprofit hospitals. I did a series of stories with ProPublica and NPR a number of years back. And, you know, we found a hospital that was just like suing all of its patients. I mean, just almost everybody in town was getting sued by this hospital. And a lot of these people were working at McDonald's and, you know, clearly, you know, should have been getting free care under the hospital's own policy that was required by federal law. But they would take people to court and people show up and, you know, they're working two jobs and trying to make ends meet or driving Uber and whatever. And they're busy and they got kids and they show up, you know, in a T-shirt and flip-flops in court and, you know, or they don't show up at all. And the hospital lawyer shows up or the debt collection firm's lawyer the hospital hires and they got a list of 50 people. Yeah, we're garnishing all these people's wages, and the judge really kind of has no choice to be like, okay, they're not here, approved, and it happens, you know. But if you know a few things, you know, don't be that person who gets hit unfairly with the bill. Anyway, so that's what we're trying to do, is to give people actionable information again that, like, so you can, you know, advocate for yourself and. Not get stuck.
Well, we'll talk about some of those nuts and bolts tools. We also want to hear from you if you have questions. 866-780-9100. Let's get to the phone. Scott is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. What's your question?
I have a million questions, but the one that I'll ask is I routinely get offers in the mail to consolidate debt. Right, you're approved for X thousand dollars, and this will reduce your overall payments to get out of the hole. Are those legit, or is there some kind of, I don't know, catch, if you will?
Well, you know, one, it kind of depends. I mean, two things. One is usually if somebody's reaching out to you to loan you money, you know, might not be the best idea because there's a lot of scam outfits out there, or, you know, or just kind of shady lenders and stuff. At the same time, you know, you get offers in the mail if you have good credit from credit card companies and, you know, balance transfer offers. And, you know, the thing is, if you're going to consolidate debt, it can be risky because what you're doing is you're taking one kind of debt. Like, let's say you got a hospital bill and you're like, oh, geez, I got this hospital bill. I went to the ER and like this, say this guy, you know, that we were just talking about, $2,000. Let's say he's like, oh, I can't really pay that. I got some other credit card debt. I'll just lump it all up on a balance transfer check and I'll get 0% for a year and I'll figure out how to pay it off. What you've done is you've converted one kind of debt into credit card debt in this case. And now you can't go back to the hospital and say, hey, you know, what's your charity care policy? What's your financial aid policy? And get that reduced. Like you lose options that you would have with one kind of debt. Or if it's student loans, I mean, this is a big mistake people make. I mean, if you have direct federal student loans and you work for a public service type organization, there's a lot of problems with this program. They're trying to sort them out. But in theory, you know, you work for 10 years and make payments and the government will forgive the rest of your debt. Or if you kind of fall on hard times, you can make $0 payments or very low payments for a while and it won't mess up your credit. And there's, you know, there's all sorts of options for you. If you consolidate by taking out a home equity loan, you know, and it's a lot of money on student loans, well, then maybe you put your house at risk and, you know, you cannot pay your student loan payments or bills in a lot of different ways legitimately. You try to tell your mortgage company, like, I'm just not going to pay for 6 months. I mean, you lose your house, right? So you just have to be careful.
Okay. But there can be points at which debt consolidation can make sense and work for people. But you do point out in the podcast that there's, again, a psychology problem there. Sometimes when you consolidate your debt, you feel like it's actually disappeared.
Right, exactly. I'm so glad that you're learning so much, Charity, from our Life Kit podcast. Right. So, I mean, look, honestly, myself, like, I got scolded by this in one episode by a personal finance expert. But it's like, look, if I go on vacation and we got the kids and, you know, back especially, they were in childcare and it's like, well, but we wanted to go on vacation. So there might be like a few $1,000. And I'd be like, look, I'll put it on a 0% balance transfer fee. I'm not going to pay the 20% interest on the credit card. That's nuts. And I do the auto pay thing. So by the time the teaser rate is over, it's paid off guaranteed because I did it the right way. You know, so I saved money. It was smart. It worked.
You worked terrific. The system, right?
Yeah. So, but the problem is, and like, sure, if you've got credit card debt and the rational economist answer is, sure, if you can consolidate that into some offer for 18 months to pay 2% up front for a balance transfer fee and then work to pay that off over the next year and a half and not be paying that crazy credit card interest, well, of course, that's the thing to do. The problem is what people who work with folks and debt counselors find, and I think some studies find this too, is like as soon as you know, emotionally it feels like, oh, I've taken care of my debt. Look, all my credit cards, the balances are zero. You know, maybe I can just keep spending money the way I was spending money. Let's order the Chinese food. And then, you know, you don't really change your behavior and you're just more in debt. So, yeah.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for your call. Let's talk about the two different approaches to paying off personal debt. You and others have used the terms snowball or avalanche. So let's start with the avalanche idea. What is that approach?
All right. And yes, I have to make sure I don't get these backwards. Right. No, avalanche is where you start with the highest interest rate debt first and probably even combine it with, you know, if there's some debt that you can get a lower interest rate on, do that. I mean, this is the rational by the numbers sort of approach where it's like, look, if you've got $5,000 on a credit card at 22% interest, it's like that is your biggest problem because you don't pay that. And, you know, that money's just, you're just going to owe a lot more, you know, deal with that first. And then
that's
it's like
really
okay,
expensive debt.
Very expensive debt. Now, if you've got a student loan at 7% or 5%, you know, well, okay, that's less of a priority. And you just go down by the numbers. And if you've got, you know, even low, you know, so just kind of the rational approach to paying the least amount of interest you can, because that's sort of like, you know, the tick on your arm sucking your blood or whatever, like, you know, that interest is just sucking your resources away. You know, get rid of the high interest stuff first. The snowball method is more of a psychology thing. It's like, well, people respond well to small victories and small wins. So that says, well, don't look at the interest. Go with the smallest debt first. So let's say you've got $300 on a credit card and that credit card's got a lower interest rate at 10%. And you might have $2,000 on another credit card with 20%, but don't even look at that. Just go after that credit card where you owe $300, pay it off, and then stop using the card. And then it's like, oh, look, I did something. I made progress. I feel good. You know, your endorphins light up or whatever. And that gives you motivation to keep going and then tackle the next one and the next one. And as you gain momentum, you're going to get better at this and you're going to conquer the world and pay off all your debt. So, and those are sort of two different approaches. And you kind of just got to figure out which one's going to work better for you.
Right. Figure out what kind of person you are. And if you can, part of the problem with the avalanche idea with starting with that most expensive debt first is that it's such a long haul for people that it's hard to stay motivated over time. Is that the big pitfall?
You know, I think that's part of it. It just doesn't have this behavioral component where it's like, you know, I guess like people don't like to watch soccer, right? Because there's takes too long to get a goal. Like it's like, you know, whereas basketball, it's like, hey, I just scored a basket. Let's keep going. You know, it's like that kind of thing.
Another piece of advice that all of your financial advisors that you talked to said, make a budget, which is, I mean, a lot of people who get into trouble with debt and a lot of people who don't just don't really want to have that regular chore to do of dealing with a budget. But it's also really hard to know how much money you're spending if you don't have one, right?
Right. And, you know, different people, I mean, some people like geek out on budgets and like budgets. And, you know, there's like we talked to the founder of this company, YNAB, you need a budget. And he's like kind of a geeky budget guy. And there's like a whole cult following of people who get super into that. I am not like that. You know, like I don't like to keep track of every cup of coffee. I mean, I tried using the app and everything. But, you know, we also, there's other ways to do it, right? That like there, if you don't want to get a spreadsheet and be super, super organized about everything, you know, like what one thing people do is that's more simple is like, okay, you divide up your spending into a few buckets, you know, like even mason jars, right? And it's like, okay, well, this is the money for groceries, and this is going to be the money for going out and having drinks with our friends or whatever, and this is going to be the money for, you know, stuff for the kids or, you know, or whatever it is, right? And then you put cash in those mason jars, or you can use envelopes, and then when you go grocery shopping, you take the envelope with you, and probably an envelope's easier than carrying around a mason jar and looks a little cooler too. But, you know, and then you can see, and then when you're out of money, that's it. Okay. I spent my grocery money, and you don't have to keep track of every time you go buy eggs. But if you're just using that one envelope, that's easier for a lot of people, and it can work really well. And also there's a psychology thing that happens as spending cash is more painful than using a credit card, and that has an impact too.
All right, you really feel it when you do it. All right, let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
Well, this is the worst case scenario. You have a credit card at one of the big box stores, and it goes into default. You close the account and all that. They write off the debt, and then a company swoops in and buys up your debt. 10 cents on the dollar, and then comes back after you for the full amount. Is there any recourse on that? I mean, do they have standing for the whole amount?
You know, that's a complicated question. I think that's one of those cases where there's multiple things. I mean, one thing we talk about in the medical debt episode is I think in another episode too is you can get debt collectors to stop harassing you. I mean, you send them a letter. We have in our debt episode more information about this and links to different sites you can go to get like a kind of template of the letter. But if you send them the right kind of letter, they have to stop calling you and harassing you, unless they're going to like take you to court. Then they can send you like a legal notice, so that can sort of get rid of the headache of sort of being hounded all the time at work and whatever by aggressive debt collectors. But, you know, some of these companies will also, the statute of limitations might be passed on the debt, and you might not have to pay it. They won't tell you that. But to answer sort of that level of detail, you know, that I think is when it's worth, okay, is there a nonprofit credit counseling outfit in my area where I can go and lay this out and be like, okay, what do I do with this? I mean, it might have to do with state law in your area. And, but there are options. You know, certainly you can get the debt collectors to stop harassing you.
And you mentioned a nonprofit agency that can help you with this. We only have about a minute before our next break, but tell me a little bit more about why you feel that's so important.
Well, you know, the odds are better you're going to get somebody who's not going to be trying to sell you something or, you know, charge you even more fees. I mean, they're just different shady outfits out there to be careful of. And if it's a real nonprofit, there's a website you can go to. We talk about where you can, they kind of, you know, list site organizations that are legit.
Okay. And so again, that's another area where you're going to need to do your homework and hopefully find somebody near you. Does it matter if they're in your state or can you look to a national organization?
You could look to a national organization. A lot of them tend to be local, you know, but you just want to start to get out there and ask around. You know, you could call legal aid services for your town and be like, hey, you know, what's the best nonprofit debt counseling group around that you guys know of, and do some homework. And maybe before the end of the show too, we'll pull up that, we'll find that website too. So maybe that'd be useful.
All right. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Chris Arnold is with me this hour, NPR personal finance correspondent, one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast. We're talking about personal debt this hour. And coming up in just a moment, Joey Beach, author of A Girl's Guide to Personal Finance, will also be joining us. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour we're talking about personal finance, debt load. We're also going to talk about savings and investment. With me, Chris Arnold, NPR personal finance correspondent and one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast. You are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And also joining us now is Joey Beach. She's executive director of Ankeny Economic Development Corporation and the author of A Girl's Guide to Personal Finance. Hello, Joey.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
And we need to get to some questions on the line. But before we go there, I want to talk to both of you about savings and investment. And Chris, earlier you had said that a lot of people feel like if they're carrying debt, that they should not be saving money or making an investment in the future. And you said that's the wrong way to go. So give us a little nutshell idea of that. And then, Joey, I'd love to hear your take on it, too. Chris?
Sure. Yeah. And you know, I also, while we were on the break there, John had called and was asking about, you know, we got talking about how to find a good credit counselor. So so the one place you can go, it's called the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. And if you go to their website, they've got they can put you in touch with local counselors in your area who they've done some work to decide, okay, this really is a nonprofit, they're okay, you can trust them. And the National Consumer Law Center has a book. I'll say that again slowly. The National Consumer Law Center, it's got a book, Surviving Debt. And I don't know, the book's like $5 or something. And it's super helpful. It's if you're really mired in debt and having a lot of problems, those are two great the book especially is a terrific resource. So.
All right. And we will put those resources up when we post the show on our website, iowapublicradio.org, later on today. So the question about saving.
Right.
If you're in debt, should you be saving?
I mean, look, here's the one. Some of this gets back to go by the numbers stuff, right? I mean, look, if you got 20% interest on a credit card, it's a big debt. I mean, you got to prioritize paying that off. But, you know, we've got a system in this country now where there aren't pensions, you know, and Social Security's got problems. And I really hope it's going to be there. I'm kind of counting on it. But, you know, if you start saving for retirement when you get out of high school, college, whenever you can start, the power of compound interest, I mean, you know, like the quote Einstein, it's the most powerful force in the universe, whatever. You know, it is amazing, right? I mean, just if you earn a 7% return on your money, it's going to double every 10 years. So if you can save, you know, 30 grand when you're pretty young, you know, especially if you got an employer matching that, that's going to go to 60 grand, to 120, to 240, you know, it's just going to, and before you know it, if you start young, I mean, even on a modest middle income, you can have well over $1 million when you're 70 years old and you're ready to retire. And so if you don't prioritize that early and take advantage of the power of compound interest, I mean, you know, you're giving up a huge thing, right? And sure, you got to pay off your student loans and stuff, but much better, especially if you got an employer match where that's free money, start saving for retirement young, because that money is so powerful, and figure out how to make the rest of the stuff work is sort of my take on it.
Well, and Joey, I know you give that advice in your book as well. It's something a lot of 20-year-olds are not thinking about, but it's something they should be thinking about, right?
Absolutely. I don't believe that you can only do one thing at a time. We've all proven that we can multitask, and we can do that with our finances as well. It's important to save and pay off the debt at the same time. And obviously, individual circumstances vary. But I think in addition to the points that Chris was making about the power of compound interest, and starting early is huge and can't be overstated. But in addition to that, there's that psychology component of it creates a habit. And so you get in the habit of saving, and then you start getting statements that show that that saving is starting to build, and then you're starting to earn some interest. And so as your debts go down, you can afford to put more into savings, and you're already in that habit. You're already in that mode, so you can be easily working at two goals at once. So absolutely, always find some way, and even if it's just a small amount, saving a little goes a long way.
All right, I want to get to the phones. Margie has been very patient on the line for us in Iowa City. Hi, Margie.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Okay, I'll try to be very brief. I need information regarding how to help my 55-year-old brother choose a retirement investor. He's a full-time mechanic, but he has no savings and very limited financial literacy. I'm power of attorney and executor of the estate for my 96-year-old dad, who is in hospice. My dad has a will that will split about $240,000 in assets three ways. My brother says he will use a friend to invest his share. The friend is telling him that he needs to get the will changed to a living will or a trust to avoid probate and lawyer fees. So I need information to tell him, choose a real financial advisor, not this friend who seems very suspicious to me.
Oh, Margie, that sounds the stakes are very high with that one. Chris, do you want to tackle that first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing you can do, and again, I'm not just plugging the podcast we do, but we've got a whole episode that's 20 minutes long on how to choose a financial advisor and should you pay for financial advice. You know, there's a bunch of stuff we could talk about there, but you're absolutely right to be cautious, right? I mean, this friend might be the greatest guy in the world with, you know, or, you know, I mean, some financial advisors just charge way too much money, or this a friend might even be kind of a shady character. I mean, who, you know, you don't know. So you got to find a trusted person. One thing you can do, I mean, one thing, there's two words that are really important to know when you're looking to find somebody to help invest money. And that is that you want to find a fee-only advisor and not a fee-based advisor. People do tricky things with the language. But a fee-only advisor means that advisor is only going to be paid by a straight-ahead fee and has no other conflicts of interest potentially leading them to advise you to, oh, yeah, you want these mutual funds that are going to charge you 10 times as much in fees because I get paid more if you pick those mutual funds. So a fee-only advisor is one thing. You can find those by going to this organization called NAPFA. It's the National Association of Professional Financial Advisors, I believe, but it's NAPFA.org.
Yes, it is the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors.
Personal Financial Advisors. And, you know, the short answer, like we asked this of the one of the greatest living investors on the planet, what does he tell his friends? This is David Swensen. He invests all of Yale's endowment. He's made $30 billion for Yale. He says, I just tell him to go to Vanguard. You know, it's a nonprofit. You can trust them. There are other good advisors out there too, or other good companies, but you know you can trust them. And that's not coming from me. I'm not going to promote one over another. But in our episode, he was very, very confident about that. When you're getting into legal stuff, like a will, I think you got to find, in that situation, you're going to need to find a lawyer who's really good, who you can trust, who can help you figure out what are we going to do with this will? What's going on? I mean, that starts to get a little trickier. But Joey, what's your take on that?
Similar to yours, one, I would look for somebody who is a fee for service so that you know up front what you're going to be paying, and their motivation is to give you advice, not sell you something, as well as they should be teaching you some things. No matter where he gets his advice, he's going to have to take some responsibility for this because ultimately it is his money. So he will want to learn some basics, and it doesn't have to be complicated. I love Warren Buffett's advice where he, in his will, and he has a substantial amount of money, is telling those who will manage the money for his family to put it in a Vanguard S&P 500 index fund. And that part is because he's confident in the U.S. economy and because it is a very low fee way of doing things. And because a huge part of savings and maximizing that savings is minimizing the fees. So I often, when in doubt, I go with Warren Buffett, go with a good index fund, preferably very low interest, no load, and get some education because ultimately it's his money. He's going to have to feel, no matter who was advising him, he's going to have to evaluate that advice.
And
so he's going to have to know some things.
Margie, I'm reading through the lines here a little bit, but it sounds like you are responsible for your brother in some ways when you mentioned having power of attorney.
Well, I'm power of attorney for my dad.
Oh, for your dad.
My brother is, he's on the spectrum. He doesn't have very good social skills. He doesn't read very well. He can fix anything. But part of it, and of course he's in California and I'm in Iowa. But that's part of it, is it's he's not the best communicator. Mm. He's sweet, he means well, but he's clueless on financial literacy.
Oh, Margie, yeah. This sounds really hard. So any advice on maybe a resource that Margie can share with her brother that might be convincing to him?
Well, you know, I mean, I would split it into the problem sort of into two parts. I mean, one is find a good lawyer in your community who you can trust and ask around, you know, at the church or if you're whatever organization you're affiliated with or find somebody who's really good. And that lawyer can help you protect your dad's interests, your interests, and come up with something that's fair as far as the will, I think, in that situation. And then in terms of how to invest the money and everything else, I mean, Joey and the guy I was talking about at Yale, David Swenson, I mean, if it's Vanguard, for example, go to a place you can trust. And then, you know, depending on your age, maybe just a S&P 500 index fund is not going to, maybe the risk of profile of that isn't exactly right. But what these places like Vanguard can do is they have age-based funds, like depending on a bunch of different, how old you are, when you want to use the money, they can put you into an extremely low cost. Again, Vanguard's run kind of like a nonprofit, and put you into a set of investments that are like index funds, passively managed, very low fee, that are appropriate to sort of the age of the person or how soon you're going to want the money or what you're going to want to do. So I would split it up. I would do, how are we going to invest this money? Okay, place like Vanguard can help you with that. What am I going to do about this legal stuff? We got to find a good lawyer.
All right, Margie, good luck. Thank you so much for your call. And let's get to Gabe. He has a related question from Altoona. Hi, Gabe.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your question?
So I was listening about the benefits of compounding interest and investing early. I'm a younger person under 30, and I need to do more with saving. I'm actually a teacher, so I've got some IPERS, public retirement funds building. But my question is, what are some resources to find more information on saving for retirement? There's a bunch of like tech startups where you can you can log in and every dollar you spend, it rounds it up. And some of that goes into a special retirement account. I met with a financial advisor, and he said that in order to start investing with him, I had to have a $10,000 minimum, which is really hard to do as a younger person. So I'm wondering what resources are there to be able to find trusted retirement savings methods?
A great question, Gabe. Joey, I'll let you tackle that one first.
All right. Well, one, just the fact that you're out there looking for the information is huge, so congratulations. And there are a lot of resources out there. Again, whenever you're looking at a resource, look at where, how do they get compensated? So is the, helps you understand what if any bias the information is that's being provided has. And, you know, I not that I want to plug all the nonprofits, but Vanguard is amazing and has some great information. What I would also encourage you to do is as you look at those, a lot of those financial institutions, a lot of the information is going to be very similar. How they say it is a little different, but a lot of the information is the same and the facts are the same. And then at the end of the day, once you've got yourself educated, make those choices of where you're going to be putting it. And a little education can go a long way and see through some of the advertising puffery and get at the education that's being offered from it.
Yeah. Chris, anything to add?
Yeah. You know, I think for young people, especially if advisors are saying you have to have a certain amount of money, I think Vanguard's level is very, very low at this point. But, you know, robo-advisors are great for young people because they tend to be more comfortable with the technology. And there's a bunch of good ones out there. I think it's Wealthfront, if I'm remembering right, is advised by the guy who wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street, Burt Malkiel, who's amazing. Betterment. There's a bunch of them, and they're very upfront about what the fees are, and you can see. But the main thing is, and we haven't talked about this yet, and this is huge. If you remember one thing from anything we've talked about, it's make it automatic, because we're just not good at saving. It's like, oh, yeah, it's Tuesday. I'm going to write a check for $200 and stick it in my. We just don't do that very often. So what you want is you want auto deduction from your paycheck to be going into a low fee account of some kind, you know, whether it's Wealthfront or Vanguard, whatever it is. And then you just don't look at it once you get it set up right. And you just adjust to that level of income in your paycheck and it becomes invisible. And if you get a raise, bump it up by 2%. You get a 4% raise, put 2% more into the retirement account. And, you know, and some into saving for a house and some into paying off your student loans, whatever. The more you can automate your savings, the more powerful it's going to be.
We have only a couple of minutes left, but that idea of automating the process, Joey, I know that that's something that you endorse as well. We've talked about the psychology of getting into debt, how easy it is for people to get into debt, but making it easier for us to save is a really great idea too, taking the power out of our own hands, right?
Absolutely. Anytime you can make it easier on yourself, it's a victory, because not only are you accomplishing the goal, but you're making it smooth and easy for yourself. And then it's just a matter of, okay, now when upping it as you go along. So, yeah, I love the idea of auto payments. So automatically out of every paycheck or however it's being done, a certain amount goes into your checking for your spending. The rest goes into saving. Hopefully part of that's automatically going into a retirement fund. Part of it's going into another savings vehicle. The more automatic it is, the better. On top of that, I've used ways where I can do automatic transfers to say, okay, I'm starting to save for this goal that I know I'm going to need or want money for in 2 years. That doesn't go into my retirement account. It's not other savings, but I want an automatic transfer. So once a month, I take some money and put it into a separate savings account specific to that goal, because that way it's in that pot of money and mentally I've designated it for that, and I don't intermingle it with something else that then later I might get tempted to say, oh, well, if I just spent a little bit more on it,
right,
I could do it. Where
we have to
if it's separated,
ourselves,
you're done.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's called mental accounting, and it's really powerful. Like, we don't want to break through those barriers.
Well, we are out of time, but thank you both so much for your advice today. Joey Beach, author of A Girl's Guide to Personal Finance, and Chris Arnold, NPR personal finance correspondent, one of the hosts of NPR's Life Kit podcast. This is Talk of Iowa.